Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinary reopening of self-inflicted wounds by Donald Trump today, who reversed his reluctant acknowledgement that neo-Nazis and white supremacists were responsible for the violence in Charlottesville, to blame what he called the alt-left, reviving his inexplicable compulsion to pander to the far-right fringe of his base for reasons that remain unclear, unless our president is in fact a racist. Anthony McLear, board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working to de-radicalize neo-Nazi and white supremacist youth, whose funding grant from the Department of Homeland Security was rescinded by Catherine Gorka, the wife of White House Deputy Sebastian Gorka, who vowed to shut down the DHS's Countering Violent Extremism program and shift funds away from white supremacist domestic terrorism to target American Muslims, along with getting his wife a job. From a former member of WAR, the White Aryan Resistance, we will learn about the mainstreaming of white racism today, away from tattooed skinheads to clean-cut people in suits, such as Richard Spencer, who look like our neighbors. Then we will speak with Michael Greenberger, the founder and director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he teaches courses on counterterrorism and emergency response. He joins us to discuss the shift in focus of Trump's DHS away from the main and well-documented problem of domestic terrorism perpetrated by white supremacists to the imaginary problem of a Muslim invasion and imposition of Sharia law, and the role of alt-right advisors at the highest levels inside the White House pushing this racist and counterproductive agenda. Then finally, we will look into Trump's renewed attacks on the press as he tries to shift blame away from his own failure of moral leadership and speak with Louis Friedland, a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin, where he directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. He joins us to discuss the right-wing media ecosystem being built by Fox's Murdoch and Sinclair Smith to serve as the Ministry of Truth and Propaganda arm for the Trump administration, and presidential aide David Gergen's remark that Trump can't heal hate in America because he has so much hate in his heart. And joining us now is Anthony McAleer, who's a board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working with individuals who wish to leave a life of hate and violence, which also helps organizations grappling with the causes of intolerance and racism. A former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance, WAR, he served as a skinhead recruiter, proprietor of Canadian Liberty Net, and a manager of a racist rock band, Odin's Law. Tony's love for his children led him on a spiritual journey of personal transformation that brought him to a place of compassion and forgiveness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tony McAleer.
Thank you for having me.
And today, the heads of the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus, and the Asian Caucus, and the Progressive Caucus sent a letter to the White House demanding the dismissal of the top aides, Stephen Bannon, Stephen Miller, and Sebastian Gorka, saying their presence in the White House has emboldened white supremacists. What's extraordinary here is that it turns out that Sebastian Gorka's wife, Catherine, was the person who convinced Homeland Security to deny a grant to your organization that had already been given by the previous administration, the Obama administration. So this obviously affects you personally, but what is your understanding of why your organization, which does so much to de-radicalize neo-Nazis, and by the way, the new funding only came out back in June, where your group was deleted from the list of people who had been previously funded. And of course, 2 months later, we witnessed what we saw in Charlottesville. So it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
It's very sort of sadly ironic, and I think there's a reluctance to accept, and you know, people don't like to look at their own stuff, and there's a reluctance to accept that on the domestic terror side, that white supremacists are a big threat, regardless of what DHS and FBI say, because both of their reports identify murders and violent acts by white supremacists post 9/11 as being a very serious. I think they 74 murders since then. So it is a real threat, but there seems to be a desire to focus solely on what they call radical Islamic terror and radical Islamic extremism. I don't like to use that phrase. I use the phrase ISIS or Al-Qaeda inspired, because I think the ideologies really, at the end of the day, have very little to do with true Islam.
Well, the part of the DHS, the counterterrorism part of the DHS that dealt with, it was called Countering Violent Extremism, and your grant was a part of that effort. On the day after Donald Trump won the election, Sebastian Gorka, the husband of Catherine Gorka, said, "I predict with absolute certitude the jettisoning of concepts such as CVE, Countering Violent Extremism." Have you ever figured out why they do not want to deal or recognize or acknowledge domestic terrorism from neo-Nazis, and why they wouldn't want somebody like you and your organization helping to de-radicalize young Americans attracted to this hateful organization?
Well, I think they have a very different view on how to deal with what he calls radical Islam. He's written a book about it, and it doesn't involve community-led efforts. I haven't read the book, but I understand it's a much more aggressive, violent solution to that, and so that's, I guess, sort of the industry that they're from. But you know, if we dial it back a bit, I still believe that within DHS, most of the rank and file and people that we dealt with still, to the very end, fought to get us this grant. But the decision came from above them, and I know recently. George Saleem, who was the head of this was about a community-led countering violent extremism program. And what the FBI and DHS had said in the last 2 years or so, which was a remarkable shift, was that they admitted that they couldn't arrest their way out of this problem, and that in order to really tackle the problem, it had to be attacked on multiple fronts, and they had to look at engaging and empowering groups from within the communities that these things are springing forth from in order to assist them separately from law enforcement. Because there's, as groups like ours or MPAC, which was the other group that lost its funding, on the ISIS Al-Qaeda inspired side, we can get into places that law enforcement can. We can have conversations and have people open up to us in a way that they couldn't do it with law enforcement. And to have the ability to work in those spaces where law enforcement can't go in partnership with law enforcement, we don't have an antagonistic relationship with law enforcement, but we're very clear that we're not an intelligence gathering organization either. But it allows us to approach it from an angle that the current strategy, which isn't working, couldn't get to. And I think it's extremely short-sighted to go back to what we know is a failed option, and that's just try and arrest the way out of the situation.
But it does seem that the president himself cannot get past this idea of assigning blame for what happened in Charlottesville to both sides. He revisited it again after you would think that he was sort of forced into making a more specific denunciation of the white supremacists, neo-Nazis, etc., who showed up and were clearly the cause of the violence. But he then went on about the other groups, what he referred to as the alt-left. So what is it about this denial that's going on there? It's reached a point now where the president has picked at this scab again, and I'm absolutely baffled as to why he's done this and why he keeps insisting that there are other sides to this story, when it's pretty clear, even though there was violence on both sides, it's pretty clear who incited this situation, who showed up in this town, who strutted their stuff, who kept shouting blood and soil, these Nazi terms, and Jews will not replace us, etc. So from your point of view, having been a part of these movements, is the president continuing to signal to the white supremacist community that I'm really not against you?
As a 501c3, I have to be very careful as to what I what I say here, but I think it's important to follow the example of community leaders like the mayor of Charlottesville, like the governor of Virginia, to call this out for what it is, and I can't think of why the president has conducted himself the way that he has. But you know, it's the thing is that I know from experience and from history, this ideology always, if left unchecked, results in violence and murder. Every decade, people are murdered in the name of this ideology. And you know, as a community, I think everyone has to express their disgust. I believe in a very nonviolent way. I don't believe violence is a solution. It only emboldens them. But I'm not sure whether there's a fear of upsetting a base or something like that. But it's what is currently happening clearly doesn't seem to be working for him.
Well, but Osama bin Laden, for example, the founder of Al-Qaeda, he attacked the United States with a view to sparking a wider between his idea of Islam and the infidels. He invited, in effect, George W. Bush had sort of obliged him in many ways by sending Christian troops to Muslim lands, and we know how that worked out. But in general, it's pretty clear that the strategy of this crazy strategy of bin Laden's was to actually provoke or renew a war with what he called the Crusaders. The same ideas infect the white supremacist movement and the neo-Nazis in this country. Dylann Roof shot those worshippers in the church in Charleston to start a race war. Timothy McVeigh, when he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma, did it apparently to start a race war. So their intentions are pretty clear, aren't they? And I don't know whether that was the intention in Charlottesville, but that has been historically their intention.
And that has been historically the rhetoric. And when somebody acts out on it, whether in a moment of unbelievable madness and stupidity and you know, with the murder of Heather and smashing into those people, like I said, that, you know, behind the scenes, behind the soft rhetoric of it's just about white culture and all this nationalism, I know the conversations that are had behind closed doors, and it's far, far darker. And it is about having a race war, and you know, this has been escalating since they had three battles in UC Berkeley. Then it moved up to Portland, and then they chose Charlottesville for the next battle. And each time they're confronted violently, they grow on it. And I know from being in the midst of it and being an organizer of events and having 3,000 people outside a building trying to smash their way in to get at me and my people, the thing that these guys thrive on is conflict and media attention.
Well, just get,
they get, want yeah. to pull people into a greater and greater conflict. This is feeding right into their narrative. And for people who think that violence is the solution, you know, this is escalating. And it's not a surprise to me that someone has finally been murdered in the wake of this violence. But, you know, I said to someone the other day, take a map of the United States and the election and look at the red counties versus the blue counties and superimpose upon that a heat map of where all the guns are in the United States and tell me that confronting these people with violence is a good idea. Because I know from having been there, their thirst and capacity for violence is bottomless.
Well, apparently there are more guns in this country than there are people, but half of the guns in this country are owned by 9% of the people.
Right. And they're all in red counties and red states.
Right. So when you just mentioned a minute ago, Tony McAleer, that you were confronted by thousands, they came after you, the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis, because of the work you do with...
No. This was I was involved. This was a meeting that was going to be a meeting with featuring Tom Metzger from White Aryan Resistance here in Vancouver, and it led to the largest anti-racist rally in the history of the province, and
ended up in
smashed windows and battles with police and that kind of thing. So I know what it's like to be that white nationalist provoking seeking attention and provoking conflict. Mm-hmm. It's what we fed upon.
Well, the co-founder of your organization, Life After Hate, Christian Piccolini, said that the white supremacy movement has been growing, but it's also been shape-shifting. It's gone from what we would have considered very open neo-Nazis and skinheads and KKK marching to people who look like our neighbors, our doctors, our teachers, our mechanics. And some of the, there were people photographing the white supremacists in Charlottesville at the university protest on Friday night and on Saturday to try and identify who these people are. And more it's turning out that these are, in fact, your neighborhood accountant, school administrator, teachers even. So what's happening to this movement that it's taken the hoods off and is out there in the open? And as your co-founder said, these are people that look like our neighbors.
Absolutely. And I think there's now two elements, I believe, to this current movement. One is the, because I don't think you'll find too many accountants and dentists were wearing the shields and clubs and the helmets. They were at the torchlight, they were at that thing, but not on the front lines of violence. So there's the traditional sort of thug element of the white nationalist movement that that loves a punch up in a street fight, and is looking for a place to do that. But now there's this sort of other element, and Richard Spencer is someone who sort of has become the face of this new, far more savvy, there's no tattoos, there's no shaved heads, they've got their what they call fashy haircuts. They're very bright, they're often at universities. A lot of them aren't violent at all. They're just as angry, and they're violent online, but not in a physical sense. Some of them are somewhat socially awkward, a bit nerdy, but they found their sense of identity and power and a place to express their rage through online community. And back in the 80s and 90s when I was active, you would go to meetings where people were gathering, and it was kind of secretive. And that presented a rather large barrier to entry. Like, people didn't want to be identified. But with the online thing, you know, you can be like Dylann Roof and just start off with a simple internet query, and you can go down a rabbit hole very quickly, and you can consume the information at the rate that you can consume it, and you can radicalize in weeks or a couple of months, whereas it took much longer before. And I think there's hundreds of thousands of these young people. You know, when you look at Spencer or Milo Yiannopoulos filling up auditoriums and university campuses across the country, that's a whole generational shift with a completely different face, and they actually often have disdain for the thuggery of the skinheads and the tattoos and that type of thing. So there's sort of two faces to that movement, and there's a very normal, you know, what we said, you know, in the time before I left was, you know, what we were doing wasn't very successful. You can't sort of entice mainstream people to follow you with drunkenness, tattoos, and street brawls. So we told people, grow your hair out, don't get tattoos, go to college, go mainstream, dress normal, join the military, get your training, and all of that kind of thing. And 20 years later, that's sort of where the movement has ended up, and it's got a clean-cut college kid face on it, and it's not nearly as threatening to the average person from an aesthetic point of view as it was in the 90s when it was, you know, alcohol-fueled thuggery.
But it's clearly more dangerous. And
absolutely.
And the work that you do, your organization Life After Hate, who lost their funding thanks to Sebastian Gorka and his wife, who are very close, at least Gorka's very close to the president. The president absolutely loves him when he goes on television. And Gorka's wife, for some reason or other, is an advisor to Homeland Security, who cut the funding for your organization. And as far as I can tell, your organization would be the best way to dissuade these young college kids from going down this rabbit hole, as you referred to it, and getting into the romance of deifying Hitler and all of the Nazi paraphernalia and believing in, you know, all this idea that somehow white men are oppressed in this country. How do you continue your work without the kind of support that you were getting from the Department of Homeland Security?
Well, we never ever did receive any funding, so it's not like we've had to scale things back. But we, you know, we're primarily a volunteer organization. There's you know, five or six of us are you know, co-founders. We have 1.5 people as on salary kind of thing. And we do consulting with policymakers and law enforcement. We get involved in research. We've got results of our research project with the Department of Justice coming out at the end of the year. And we do speaking and stuff, and we rely on the donations from ordinary citizens who, if their government won't support it, they feel it's important enough to support it. And we've had a tremendous amount of donation support over the last couple of days as people realize that this threat is very real, and there's nobody out there that's, tackling and working with these neo-Nazis to help them leave that movement. And it really is an important thing, because we've helped hundreds leave so far, and we've got a private Facebook support group that's got 50, 60 people in it now that are, we're supporting, but they're starting to support each other. So it's mm-hmm. it's scalable and sure. self-regenerating, and it's really positive to see it grow organically like that. So,
well, just in closing, Tony McAleer, David Gergen, who served four presidents, just said yesterday that Trump can't heal hate in America because he has so much hate in his heart. Now, I won't ask you to comment on that because you are, as you say, a nonprofit that's supposed to educate, not indoctrinate, and you're doing a very important work in trying to get these young neo-Nazis and white supremacists to see another way of looking at the world and de-radicalizing them. So just in closing, tell us about your personal transformation, because clearly you had hate in your heart, and now it seems that you are redeeming yourself. And I guess it's what Martin Luther King says, that the hate cannot conquer hate. Only love can do that.
Yeah, and what we find is, since the whole thing is driven by shame, what's the antidote to shame? Empathy and compassion. And that was what ultimately changed things for me. And it came in two forms. One was the birth of my daughter and then my son 15 months later. And the beautiful thing about children is they love us unconditionally. And when we're compassionate with another human being, what we do is we hold up a mirror and allow them to see their humanity reflected back at them when they can't see it themselves when they look in the mirror. And my children provided a safe place for me to let the guard down, to drop the shielding that was keeping me disconnected and protected, and what I felt was safe. That got me so far. And then the second piece was with a counselor who I'd met and really connected with. And for, my first therapy session with him, I'm telling him about, very shamefully, the things that I had done and the violence I had committed. And an English guy about 10 years older, and I was born in Liverpool. He was born in Manchester, and we really connected on quirky English things like Monty Python. And he starts smiling at me, and I go, this is odd. I wasn't expecting that. And I go, why are you smiling? And he goes, I was born Jewish, right? So here was this Jewish man who wanted to help me heal, loved me, could see the humanity in me when I couldn't see it. And there I was, someone who had advocated the annihilation of him and his people, and that really began an incredible relationship, but really messed with my head, because I still carried, in his words, I'd left the movement, but the movement hadn't entirely left me. And that compassion from someone whom I didn't feel I deserved it from, the compassion from someone who I had dehumanized, was an incredibly powerful transformational piece. And, I think it's up to us as individuals to look at that practice of compassion. And the hardest thing in the world to do is to have compassion for somebody who has no compassion, but they are exactly the people that need it most.
Well, Anthony McAleer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthony McAleer, who's board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working with individuals who wish to leave a life of hate and violence, which also helps organizations grappling with the causes of intolerance and racism. A former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance War, he served as a skinhead recruiter, proprietor of Canadian Liberty Net, and a manager of the racist rock band Odin's Law. Tony's love for his children led him on a spiritual journey of personal transformation that brought him to a place of compassion and forgiveness. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the shift in focus of Trump's DHS away from the main problem of white domestic terrorism to the imaginary problem of a Muslim invasion.
Transcending fear in the 21st century. Lost in psychic dire straits.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Greenberger, the founder and director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security, and a professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law, where he teaches courses on counterterrorism and emergency response. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger. So, Michael, what do you make of the president, after being criticized for not speaking up and naming names about who was really responsible for the outrages that happened in Charlottesville, and he finally had a press conference yesterday where he mentioned by name white supremacists, neo-Nazis, etc. Today, he reverses himself Tuesday, and now he goes on about how it's all... I initially said the right thing, and there really are two sides to this, and there's an alt-left as well as an alt-right. Why is this president picking this scab again?
I think there are many people in this country who are asking themselves that question. And when I say many people, I'm talking about Democrats, Republicans, and independents. It's inexplicable, and it plays into... some very dangerous thinking, because when we look at threats from extremism, the most serious threats, and when I say threats, I include terrorist threats, come from white supremacists, neo-Nazis, etc. And one story that up until now has been buried, sort of as an inside baseball story, is that President Obama started a program called Countering Violent Extremism. And the thesis of the program was that many homegrown terrorists are captured by philosophies that are a danger to the country and lead to dangerous extremism. The criticism of the program that Obama started was it was too law enforcement oriented, but the important point about the Obama program is it didn't focus on any particular group. And since Trump has come into the White House, they've taken the term countering violent extremism without focusing on groups, but focusing about individuals who are troubled and may cause damage, and they've converted it into countering Islamic extremism. And therefore, writing out of the program white supremacist groups. And what we're seeing now, this loss of $400,000 to this group that was combating white extremism, is only the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg is that the entire program in the Department of Homeland Security has abandoned looking at what probably is universally recognized as the most dangerous form of terrorism, and focusing only on Islamic terrorism. And that's caused a lot of disruption in the country. My group, the Center for Health and Homeland Security, has been involved in this. We're working with a lot of local governments on this issue, and we had to back away from the federal program because it was focused on Muslims and not on the entirety of the threat to the United States. I never thought this would come to the public attention. I thought it was too inside baseball. And if there's a silver lining to what's happened in Charlottesville, is this issue is getting more prominence. And essentially, the Trump administration has written off not all forms of terrorism, but a very important form of terrorism that comes from white supremacists and neo-Nazis, and I hope that gets corrected as a result of this.
But it looks as though Sebastian Gorka, who is an aide to the president, has a major role in this reversal. The day after Trump won the election, Sebastian Gorka said, "I predict with absolute certitude the jettisoning of concepts such as countering violent extremism." And then his wife, Catherine Gorka, becomes the person who is given a job at Department of Homeland Security and access the program, and then cuts funding also for other groups such as the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Yes.
There you have a direct...
It's extremely self-defeating. And essentially, you know, as we see from what happened in Charlottesville, the mother of the person who drove into the crowd had twice called 911 being worried about her son. Every terrorist attack that you have in front of you, you peel back the details, and authorities have been called ahead of time by the perpetrator because of the fear of that person being having gone off the rails psychologically. Now, and what we're seeing is it's futile to say, well, this is a problem with Muslims or it's a problem with white supremacists. It's a problem with individuals. And the way the program was conceived is if somebody calls in with that kind of problem, it's filtered to the social services, and someone of responsibility within the community tries to help the person calling in, the mother, the friend, the wife, the husband, what have you, to deal with the problem. And essentially, from day one, the Trump administration said, look, the only thing we're going to worry about is Islamic extremism. We're not going to worry about extremism as a whole. And there's still funding for this. There's a lot of funding. There are millions of dollars being offered out by the Trump administration, but you only get the funding if you focus on Islamic extremism, not extremism as a general matter. And as Charlottesville has made clear, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, are part of this problem. And the Trump administration from virtually day one said, we don't want to look at that. We only want to look at Muslims.
But Sebastian Gorka has a past that's very questionable. A lot of sympathy for fascism in Hungary and anti-Semitism in terms of organizations that he claims that he only wore a medal to the inaugural ball of when Trump was elected because it was awarded to his father. But just a week ago on Breitbart News, he went after Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, who questioned the idea. He was questioning the idea of this lone wolf idea of terrorism like McVeigh, and basically saying, no, it's all the Muslims. And just last Wednesday, Sebastian Gorka said, oh, it's the white man, it's the white supremacist, that's the problem. No, it isn't, Maggie Haberman. So I think that gives you a window into this guy's thinking. And if
it absolutely does. And as you say, both he and his wife are in a position of power. But this runs much deeper than the Gorkas. This is a philosophy that's permeating important sectors of the White House, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security. And that is that politically, they do not want to alienate the white supremacist group. They've de-emphasized the importance that group plays in fostering terrorism, and it's politically popular for them to blame everything on Islamic terrorism. And the concept as it was created was you do not focus on groups, you focus on people who are presenting problems and a threat of terrorism. It can come from anywhere. You deal with the individual. And as I said, if you look at every major terror attack, whether it's in the United States or England or elsewhere, the perpetrator has been called out by someone to whom the perpetrator is close. Police authorities were called. Manchester, there's an investigation of the police department for failing to follow up on people reporting that the perpetrator was, before it ever happened, was a problem. Now, one of the problems is the criticisms of civil liberties is you can't make this a law enforcement problem. It's a social service problem. But the Trump administration is keeping it in the law enforcement sector, but they only want to focus on the Islamic community. It's a real disaster, and as I said, if there's a silver lining to this tragedy in Charlottesville, is bringing this issue to the forefront. It's a major mistake in terms of fighting terrorism, and I hope that the facts will lead to its correction.
But the question then looms, is the Trump administration Are they fellow travelers in bed with these right-wing racists? What possible advantage does it give to them? I mean, or are they just stupid? I mean, I saw a piece on television the other day of one of the leaders of MS-13, this hideous street gang. Donald Trump made a big deal. He made a speech about going after MS-13. This MS-13 leader said that Trump has been the best thing that ever happened to the MS-13 gang because he's attacked the entire Hispanic community, and therefore they won't talk to the police anymore. So it's given MS-13 a free pass because the local community don't report them to the police.
Yes. Well, the problem here essentially, and I think this is widely recognized, is that an important part of Trump's base is the white supremacist group. And that's why he doesn't want to call them out. That's why he went through the exercise when he first said it's everybody's fault and then went back on what he said yesterday, that focusing on neo-Nazis and white supremacists, and today going back to everybody's fault. David Duke cheering him on. And I think when you look at election analyses, he has substantial support from this group, and he doesn't want to alienate them. The problem he's going to face, however, is that he's alienating almost everybody else, even the Republican Party, almost to a person, has criticized the president on this. And I think it's a very, very serious mistake. But it's really a political choice he's making. He wants this support. He thinks this support is important. And it may have been important enough in November of 2016 to have carried him over the finish line, having these people lining up with him. But by bending over backwards to appease them, I think he's lost a lot of ground.
Well, it's just so ahistorical. I mean, Thomas Jefferson said, an ignorant people cannot remain a free people. And the idea that I saw Nazi swastikas, big flags with Nazi swastikas in Charlottesville, and it prompted a conservative senator like Orrin Hatch to say, my brother was killed by the Nazis in World War II. For God's sake, hundreds of thousands of Americans died fighting this genocidal maniac and his regime, Adolf Hitler. And here you got these people in America celebrating this mass murderer. It's crazy.
I couldn't agree more. And the term ahistorical is the key term here. The president has very little historical context for his governance, and he has looked at a short-term gain. People like David Duke and the neo-Nazis and white supremacists have, and we know this from election data, given him support. And he's bent over backwards to appease them, but it looks today as if this is a horrific, not only ahistorical, but impolitic thing for him to be doing.
Well, Michael Greenberger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the founder and director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security and a professor at the University of Maryland's Francis King Carey School of Law, where he teaches courses on counterterrorism and emergency response. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Trump's renewed attacks on the press as he tries to shift blame away from his own failure of moral leadership.
Man, see that we all brothers, not cause things the same, because we lack the same color, and that's gray. Now that's man, can't burn his cross, cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters, just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lewis Friedland, who is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and an affiliated professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he founded and directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. His books include Public Journalism, Past and Future, and Covering the World, International Television News Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lewis Friedland.
Thank you.
And clearly, Donald Trump is driving a wedge through the media in this country, in effect creating an alternative media or alternative facts. And he's attacking the fake news, which is what he calls the rest of the media, except for the ones that Fox and Sinclair and Breitbart, etc., that support him. But he seems to have amplified his attacks just in the last couple of days, perhaps to shift blame for his failure of leadership, or at least moral leadership, in terms of what happened in Charlottesville. He tweeted out yesterday that the press are bad people. He retweeted a picture of an express train with Trump written on it crashing into somebody with a CNN logo on it, on him. And then he's also attacked a CNN reporter yesterday at the press conference, after which he finally grudgingly admitted or tried to do some cleanup on his failure to attack the real cause of the violence in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, etc. After he'd finished those remarks, Jim Acosta of CNN asked him about the press conference he was supposed to hold, and he got very nasty and said, "You're fake news," and stormed out. So this is a battle. Have you ever seen anything, having covered media in this country for a long time, that we are literally having almost two sort of different universes of reality in America?
I think that's a fair way of posing it, Ian. And no, I definitely have never seen anything like this. I don't think many Americans have. We would have to go back at least to the 1930s to see a nation where these kinds of divisions existed, and even then, while there was a alternative press on both the left and the right, there wasn't this level of vituperation. Of course, Franklin Roosevelt was attacked by many of the, at that time, right-wing newspapers, and he attacked them back, but that's the only analogy I can think of in this century, the last century.
But as a result of the attacks by Father Coughlin and Colonel McCormick and other media barons, Roosevelt introduced the Fairness Doctrine, which was a very simple and elegant way to tone down extreme speech in the media, meaning that if a media owner wanted to use his media assets as a personal soapbox, he would have to offer equal time to the opposing point of view. And that had the effect of calming things down over the decades until 1987, when Ronald Reagan got rid of the Fairness Doctrine at the urging of Rupert Murdoch and others. And that's been the birth of right-wing media, has it not, from that moment on?
No, absolutely. I think you're completely right that the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine under then FCC Chairman Mark Fowler, who basically famously analogized media to a toaster. Essentially, it was another commodity like any other. But, of course, the Fairness Doctrine was built on the idea that the broadcast airwaves are owned by the public, that they're a public good, and that, as such, they needed to have the public needed full and fair access to them. And that was the foundation of the Fairness Doctrine. And it did for a very long time, through the first wave of radio and television, constrain the kind of hyper-partisan, vituperative media that we're now not just seeing today, but swimming within today. And so I think that that was a pivotal point, the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987, and it's not incidental that many of the partisans right now of the media environment that we live in are extremely worried about the return of the Fairness Doctrine. Rush Limbaugh regularly editorializes or actually promotes fear of the return of the Fairness Doctrine, and so did actually FCC Chairman Ajit Pai not too long ago, when he helped suppress a report on the state of communications in the United States. So that is a pivotal point, absolutely.
Well, it's not going to happen under the Fairness Doctrine is not going to be reintroduced under Ajit Pai and with the Republicans
definitely
in control.
Not. So again, no, I mean, it's I think it's a pivotal point for not just for people like Pi, who are really working hand in hand with the National Association of Broadcasters and others towards sweeping deregulation, but it really is the basis of the really transformation of the media landscape. I lived and was worked in news in Milwaukee when I first came to Wisconsin 30 years ago or so, not long after the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine. I saw two powerhouse radio stations essentially transformed into conservative media outlets, and this was in 1987. The two stations that covered the entire state. And today in Wisconsin, as a result, in part, in any given day, there's about 70 hours of conservative talk media in our state, in our relatively small state. Of course, that's broken down by market. That's cumulative. But that means roughly 6 hours a day of conservative talk radio in every city in our state. And that's a direct result of the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine.
There's no question that unleashing right-wing media, and they were ready to hit the ground running when the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, has changed the political debate and given it a tremendous advantage to the conservatives. An example being here in Los Angeles, in Southern California, we have what's called the Inland Empire to the east of Los Angeles. And all of the Inland Empire was represented by Democratic congresspeople. But because a lot of people commute from the Inland Empire into Los Angeles, into other parts of Southern California, many of the residents of the Inland Empire spend hours a day in their cars. And a lot of sociologists have done research to indicate that the amount of time they spend in their car being exposed to Rush Limbaugh and his clones who dominate AM and FM radio, that has turned the Inland Empire from Democratic to Republican districts. So I don't know how scientific those findings are, but it may well be an indicator. Let's talk then about what's happening now with this president, who, by the way, I was very struck by the remarks by David Gergen, who served 4 United States presidents, and he sort of represents where Republicans used to be sensible. He said that Trump can't heal hate in America because he has so much hate in his heart. And it's so clear that this man couldn't repudiate the hatred we saw in Charlottesville. He had to be forced into doing it. And then he gets mad at the media and signals to the very same people that he's criticized, the alt-right neo-Nazis, and sort of saying, blaming everything on the media. And then he tweets out or retweets this picture of an express train with Trump on the side smashing into CNN person with a CNN logo on them. And then he attacks the CNN guy for asking what happened to the press conference you promised and calls him fake news. And then he retweets an extraordinary thing that he retweeted, which I find absolutely surreal. And that is that he took down, by the way, he took down the tweet of the express train, but he allowed the retweet to remain on the president's feed from a Monday night retweet of an alt-right figure known as Jack Prosbiak, who had complained online that violent crimes in Chicago wasn't getting the same media attention as the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. This same guy that the president of the United States retweeted is one of the people who promoted that conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. These are the kind of people that the president of the United States, I mean, if you retweet somebody, that's an endorsement of their opinion, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is wittingly or unwittingly. Sometimes it's hard to separate those two things out with the president's tweet stream. But definitely, it's a re-endorsement of the views of those people. And there's a natural affinity between the president and those and the alt-right. I think that's pretty obvious to almost anybody who's paying attention.
Right, but Lou, where you've got, he's on the defensive about being too cozy with the alt-right, and then he retweets a prominent alt-right figure. That's pretty.
I agree. It's in a way, it's it's so remarkable at so many levels. You know, not the moral turpitude involved, most importantly, but also at the level of political misunderstanding or tone deafness. And I think that speaks to the larger issue that you raised a few minutes ago, that there is an alternative right-wing ecosystem in the United States, right-wing media ecosystem. And you know, we might have said conservative only a few years ago, and Fox News certainly has drifted farther and farther and farther to the right over since its founding. It was always, of course, a conservative media outlet, but it's become a true right-wing media outlet. And when it begins to merge with Breitbart and the other aspects of the conservative media ecosystem, including older ones like Drudge, which are still there and still very powerful, you have an entire worldview that's available to millions and millions of people every day, and they can feed each other essentially conspiratorial fantasies. And so that's the environment in which it thrives. I mean, what's unique and new is that we have a president who shares those fantasies and actively feeds those fantasies and uses them to explain or attempt to explain away essentially any facts that he doesn't like. And I think one of the big questions that we're going to be facing is, moving forward, is to what extent is that alternative, not only alternative media system, but alternative worldview, really, how much is that moving outside of this 15 or 20% of Americans who really live there? And to what extent is it, you know, influencing people, the 30-40% of American people who sort of live in the middle? And that's, I think, one of the biggest and most, you know, challenging and frightening questions that we're going to be seeing in the, well, certainly in 2018 coming up.
Well, that's actually the area that I wanted to talk about, because I don't think you can write off Trump, and a lot of liberals think he's going to get impeached, and they kind of invested in that without bothering to come up with an alternative narrative so that they can find candidates to challenge this guy with platforms and programs and ideas, which the Democratic Party are sorely lacking in. So it's a really trap, I think, to imagine that this guy's going to self-destruct, or the 25th Amendment's going to be invoked, or whatever. I mean, he's completely out to lunch. We know that. And he's reckless and dangerous and totally unqualified. And it's a horrible accident that's befallen this country that this man has been elected. But still, can he pull it off? In other words, with this new right-wing media ecosystem that you referred to, if you got Sinclair, which is, they're going to make it more powerful, you got Fox, they're going more and more off the rails and more extreme, you got Breitbart and Drudge and all these people, that crowd combined that are creating this alternative universe, along with voter suppression, along with the massive amount of money from Sheldon Adelson and Robert Mercer, these big billionaire backers of Trump, and then on top of that, if Trump creates a little wag the dog war, maybe goes after Iran, who nobody likes Iran, they hate the mullahs, you know, death to America, that'd be very popular. He even mentioned going to war against Venezuela. So this guy's looking around, right. He's looking around for a war, you know. Do you think those things combined could be enough to keep the Republicans in power in 2018 and have this guy reelected in 2020?
You know, I think that's a big question. I think that this is, I'm of two minds about this, like a lot of people. I have sort of Democratic hopes and also the harder edge scenario. And I can't honestly say that I would put a lot of money on one or the other right now. But to be honest, I think a lot of people in the middle, and I'm seeing this in Wisconsin right now, it's a very good place to live because you get a chance to see how many people in the middle, many people who are conservative, who vote for sometimes, not infrequently now, for conservative Republicans, I think a lot of them are both repulsed, in some cases, but certainly put off by the company that Trump is keeping. I don't think this is a country yet where you can keep company with Klan wizards and neo-Nazis and claim America. So, well, I think that the right wing...
Can you read it again? You dropped out. And claim to represent America is what you wanted to say.
The mainstream of America. I think that most people, including many conservative Republicans, not hardcore, you know, not politicos, but people, you know, farmers out here, people who've, you know, work hard and don't necessarily pay a huge amount of attention to politics day in and day out. They don't really like the president palling around with Nazis. And so I think at some point, and I don't want to overstate this, but I think that at some point you reach the limits of the right-wing ecosystem. It's very powerful for ginning up your own supporters, and it will keep the people who are within it highly charged and highly motivated. But I also think that in many ways, the events of the past few days, not just for people on the left or progressives day one, but I think a lot of the people who either voted for Trump or who didn't vote or who are trying, still forming an opinion, the so-called wait-and-see crowd, what's he, you know, is he going to fulfill his promises to bring back jobs and so on. I think that people are starting to get fairly weary of the guy. And you know, we won't know. The acid test, the first test is really going to be 2018. But I think that you know, the right-wing ecosystem has its limits. I don't want to underestimate it. It's very powerful, and for those who live within it, it's, you know, it's a poisonous fantasy world. So I, you know, I'm not certainly not dismissing it, but I'm saying that I think some of it's coming to light now to people who really haven't paid that much attention, and I think it's likely to have as many actually more negative effects in the long run than positive ones for Trump.
Well, Louis Friedland, I hope you're right, and that the American people, the better angels of our nature, emerge here to overcome this hate and this excuse for hate and these hateful people that Trump has around him in the White House. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Louis Friedland, who's a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and an affiliated professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he founded and directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. His books include Public Journalism, Past and Future, and Covering the World, International Television News Services. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.